Hello, everybody. J.J. Cooper, Jacob Rudner, Baseball America College Podcast. And today, fitting time to do this. We are in the summer. But most importantly, Jacob just got done 4 days, I believe it was, altogether at Area Code Games, one of the key summer showcase events of the summer. And so what we're going to talk about today is kind of the college baseball perspective of that, which is recruiting. It's a very important topic, always is. In college baseball, but most importantly, what we're going to talk about today is how it is kind of it has changed, it is still changing, and just off of a week where you've been seeing coaches and talking to a lot of people, can't think of a better time to do this. Jacob, good to see you. You know, you look like you did a good job of not, you know, it's California, it's not the same as like going out to an event, you know, and roasting at Hoover or and Kerry at USA Baseball, but still, like you avoided the, you know, you avoided the sunburn and things like that. Good to see you. How was Area Codes?
It was great. It was hot. It required ample sunscreenage, so I know that people were there and very concerned about the heat. But all in all, no, it was a good weekend, and I think that we were able to see an early, very valuable look at the high school players in the 2027 class. We got to look at some guys who are in the 2028 class who moved up into the upper class games that maybe are some reclassification candidates. And I think that this is the first building block for the draft class. And that's how I know a lot of people look at it. You, on one hand, you're going to see a lot of guys who are almost certain, if not already certain, pro guys immediately. We will never see them play college baseball. And then on the other hand, I think the weekend was really valuable for the troves of college coaches who made the pilgrimage to Long Beach, California, in order to be able to see some of the college stars of the future and some of the guys who will go play university level baseball. And that's always fun too. So it was a very productive weekend. It was a very talented weekend. And it'll be interesting to see exactly what this group produces and who goes where as the year unfolds.
So that just leads to the question though, which is, okay, so those coaches are out there. And part of it is to see and be seen by the players who are already, you've already secured their commitments. They are planning to come, but you're also obviously recruiting other players. You're evaluating players. But the open-ending question we'll start with here is that's always been true, right? If we were talking about Area Codes 2002, that would be true. How is it different now, though? How has it changed in this 2020 landscape, which is a very different landscape than it was just 5, 6, 7 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are two main categories of change when it comes to what Area Codes means and what that means for the recruiting landscape. On one hand, the transfer portal, which if you missed our previous episode of the College Podcast, JJ and I had a really in-depth conversation just about kind of the state of the transfer portal this year's cycle. So I recommend you go and listen to that. But the transfer portal has seismically shifted the recruiting landscape as far as who wants what to build their roster. If you are a high major SEC, ACC, Big 12, Sun Belt team, and you are competitive and looking to be able to compete at the end of the year in the baseball season, the players that you're targeting are transfers. You want to be older. A less talented from a pro baseball perspective, college player who is older and more physically mature is a better baseball player presently for the sake of being able to contribute to winning than a very high ceiling freshman player who may be a better prospect, maybe somebody who goes on and has a better pro career, but is still very raw, both physically and in terms of just how they play the game. Those players are talented, but they are not necessarily quote-unquote immediate winning players. And so teams at the high major level are less inclined to go and take a whole bunch of these guys. The developmental draft pick, or the developmental kid, the three-star, if you will, who gets to campus 9 times out of 10. This is not a draft pick. This is somebody who has years of amateur development still in front of them before they can be a prospect, if they will ever become a prospect. Those players are no longer in as high a demand as they used to be. And so I think that the first big change that we saw this weekend is there are more kids than not who fall into that category. There are more guys who are not prospects today than the guys who are very obvious, direct out of high school, straight to pro type players. Those guys, I think, are having a harder time finding their way onto high major rosters. And, you know, consequently, they are also having a harder time finding their way into playing time when they do get to campus. So change number one. Change number two, I think, is a little bit more subtle if you don't pay attention very closely to college recruiting, and that is regionality. In days of old, especially in college baseball, I think that it was very apparent who was getting what. UCLA, and still to an effect, does this, but UCLA is going to go and get the best players from Southern California. USC will push them for those types of players. The prominent Arizona schools, Arizona and Arizona State, will pick from their own backyards in Arizona, which is very talent-rich. They're going to go up into Nevada and go and get some good players. They're going to go into Southern California. Regionally speaking, you would see a lot of those players stick to that. I think the Pacific Northwest maybe was a little bit more of a fluid zone, but still you're seeing the best of those players go to Oregon State. You're seeing the best of those players maybe go to Oregon in recent years. That's kind of been a more modern trend under Mark Wasikowski than it was before him. But players stuck where they went. Players from the state of Arkansas who were really good, they would stay at the University of Arkansas, or they would go to one of the many talented baseball schools in that state. Florida kids, and to a degree, I think that that's a state that really has kind of held on to this, but Florida kids used to stay at the Florida schools. Now I think we're seeing the powers that exist in college baseball and even beyond that really travel to go and find talent. There is no longer as big a regional stranglehold per university on the area that they exist in, where now you have guys like Jay Johnson at LSU loves to go and recruit California. Tony Vitello, when he was at Tennessee, loved to go and recruit out of state. Go ahead, yeah.
I just want to ask with that. Obviously, there's a variety of reasons for that. How much of that is the pervasiveness of college baseball and TV now compared to 10, 15, 20 years ago? Because if you're a kid from California and you went to the SEC 15 years ago, your parents probably weren't going to see you play nearly as much as they would if you stayed home.
And even if your parents were going to see you play, I don't know that the SEC recruiting mindset was to go and spend resources to go out to California and decide if a player from out there, unless they were obviously among the best of the best, was a fit for your roster in the Southeast in the best conference in college baseball. They tended to stay within the Southeast. You know, some of the schools would venture out a little bit. Texas was a recruiting hotbed for the SEC, but didn't really expand consistently beyond that. Not nearly as much as it does today. To your point, I think that the popularity of college baseball has transcended the regionality of it to a degree. But at the same time, I think that talent is starting to flock to where talent is going. The SEC, that to basically mean the best players are going to play in the SEC and the ACC. And after that, you know, the Big 10, the Big 12, and the Sun Belt. I think that high school players from California and Oregon and Nevada and Arizona are seeing that they are A, capable of going into those leagues and being very successful, but B, that the coaches in those leagues are now more willing than they've been to spend the resources to go and find the really talented kids, even if they come from out of their region. Recruiting budgets in college baseball, particularly at the top, are as big as they've ever been. NIL obviously is a factor, and we saw that play out. We've talked about it on this podcast. In the draft, there were a number of high school guys that decided to go to campus. There were a number of college guys who decided to stay on campus due to NIL and the fact that you can make more money by going to one more year of school, or in the case of a high schooler, 3 years of school and then trying to draft again later. That's a lucrative business now. And so the combination of those things, you know, the centralization of talent in certain conferences in college baseball, plus the ability to be compensated rather handsomely if you're good, that is a real pull. There's gravity to that. And I think that we have seen over the last couple of years, and certainly right now, that has, you know, increased in terms of its overall strength.
I want to go back to your first point, though. The lower level, and again, lower level here is talking about a really good, like a college capable base, Division I capable baseball player, right? But to your point, because we also throw in that we had a couple of years ago the change where no longer were coaches having to worry about trying to get non-binding verbal commitments from eighth and ninth graders, because the rules changed and now it's the start of your junior year, you know, your really scholastic junior year, August 1 of your going into your junior year is when you are they're able to contact, is when you start to see these commitments happen, right? Which is very different and does mean that now we're not seeing also the kid who looked like he was going to be the star as a ninth grader who by the time you get to your senior year, it's like, oh, well, that kid's really not at the level to play at this school. Taking that all out of it. But how much of this, when you said like that those players are less in demand, how much of this is kind of a mindset question with those players? Because to be honest, a lot of those players before, like, yes, it is 100% true. I would say that we've seen a little bit of change in the dyed in the wool. Like they have the, you know, they have LSU colored bed sheets, right? The guy who comes in as a freshman, you know, grew up in, you know, in Louisiana, comes in a freshman knowing they're never going to play. They're probably going to start playing as a sophomore and they're going to play as a junior. There's less of kind of that path now. But more than that, more of those players are the ones who would go to school, like have an elite, because the player you're talking about would often have an elite school that they signed with. And they would be there for a year, but it would not work out a lot of times, right? Those are the players who would get done with fall ball, and it's like, yeah, this is not going to work here. How much of this is that the recruiting's changed? Because obviously now those spots are being replaced by transfers and all that. But how much of it also is kind of a mindset change that they're now players and their parents and all that are having to get used to the fact that it's okay to be going to different school than, you know, that than the conference you thought you wanted to be in for year one?
You know, I think that that matters, but I go back to what I said a minute ago, which is that I really just don't think that there's room for some of these players on the roster. Like, you can have a really good mindset and be willing to go grind it out and be the kid that's going to work your way up from the bottom of a roster and then play as a sophomore or a junior and have a really good success story. That's possible. Like, this is not me saying that I think that that's out of the question in modern college baseball, but I do think that there are limitations that still exist that are out of the player's control. And it's not necessarily something that can be corrected with effort or, you know, conviction and, you know, belief from parents or whatever you want to call it. You know, you got 34 roster spots. You got 34 roster right. spots. And that number, we know from coaches, we've talked about it, is hard to get to. Like, there is, with the transfer portal and high school recruiting, the amount of talent that exists in college baseball right now is at an all-time high. The draft is shorter than it's been. It's probably going to get shorter. I think
well, we don't know that. I would not say it could get shorter.
Sure.
I know there's a lot of talk about it, but that is a negotiated part of the CBA. Yeah.
Sure. Allow me to rephrase then. I think that the running expectation among a lot of college coaches is that the draft is going to get shorter. And the expectation among a lot of scouts as well is that the draft is going to get shorter. So if or when that does happen, we will see more players than exist right now in the player pool for college baseball. More players, fewer roster spots, less places to go. So I do think that even if you are very confident that you can go and make it happen as a, you know, non-participating freshman who's going to redshirt at a place like, say, Tennessee, you know, for your first year, and as a sophomore, your realistic goal is to see the field as a replacement level player who, you know, gets on the field if somebody really gets hurt, you get some extended time. And then as a junior, you know, perfect outcome is that you are a starter. If it's a good junior year, you're a draft. If not, you're very content to go back to school and be a no doubt starter as a senior. That was a track that used to exist. I don't know that there are enough roster spots for that player to be able to rely on that outcome. I think that it is very hard now to be able to get on that track. Some kids will do it. This is not an extinct demographic. I think we will continue to see it, but it will become much, much, much more rare.
And I think it's also fair to say, and tell me if I'm wrong, but when we're describing this also, even if you say that that's your track and it starts, you start the process that way. And again, at whatever school it is, there's no guarantee. When you said, when you're trying to get to 34 roster spots, even if the coaching staff and all at whatever school is on board with this as well, and it's like, yep, this is a realistic plan. We know that this is how you're coming in. circumstances can change where all of a sudden you're the player who's at risk, and all of a sudden the plans are going to change because, oh, we need a roster spot for your second year. And if our choices are, we're going to have to bump someone who is part of our significant plans for this year, or someone who we hope to see next year, we may tell you, we still want to see you next year or the year after, but you don't, we don't have room for you right now here, right?
Absolutely. And I think that there is something to be said for the, just the general overall mindset, the operating mindset of a recruiter, of somebody who is in charge of putting together a college roster. If you're doing your job correctly, and there are many, many coaches who would tell you this, you are trying to over-recruit, you're trying to out-recruit the players who you currently have with the players that you're going to bring in. If you are an elite recruiter, and it doesn't always work out this way, it's impossible, but in a perfect world, every player who joins your program should be better than somebody who's currently on the roster. That is how you foster improvement. So if that's your mindset, you are not, as a coach, required to, you know, in no like moral way are you obligated to try to not out-recruit somebody, a developmental type player on your roster, with a transfer, with another freshman who might be more talented, who may push the guy who you committed to the track that we just laid out, you know, getting onto the field a little bit as a sophomore, being a starter type as a junior, being a starter type as a senior. You might not get that opportunity because of how many options exist in the recruiting world right now. A coach, after a season ends, can call any number of Division 1, 2, 3, NAIA, JUCO, high school players and add to their roster, which they can then pay for. So remember, not only are you dealing with just the sheer fact of recruiters trying to bring in better players than you constantly, but they are able to entice said better player with money that is able to sweeten the deal to almost ensure that they get said player, which puts you at another disadvantage. And so
can I just ask with that? Like, one of the things with this is that this is a, again, this is something to me feel that is very different. I know that we can talk about it, and from a purely academic and old school kind of mindset of it's the school, it's the fit and all that. But there is what you just said there to me. And again, please tell me, this is my perception. I want to see what your perception is. The money does talk though, right? Which is, if you have very little invested in a player at a school, that could be one of two things. In one way, that could be a bargain, right? That's, if you think of this from a kind of professional sports, that's the player who's at league minimum, who's helping you afford the other players, right? If you have a good player who, for whatever reason, is willing to play for you for less, whether it's less NIL, whether, you know, all, hey, in some cases in the past, it's been this player will even play, you know, pay so that you can use scholarship elsewhere. Although in the world of 34 and the, some of the conferences we're talking about, that's less of a factor now. But so it could be that, but it also could be that there is a, it, you sounds mercenary, but there is a real component to this, which is, what does a team think of you? What does a program think of you? They kind of tell you that with the resources that they devote to you, right? Like, if you think coming into a year that the kid, and again, I'm not saying everyone always knows, but if you're battling for the second base job with someone who was just paid $200,000 in NIL to come in, and you're not making anything in NIL or $25,000 in NIL, yes, transfers make more than players who stay at home generally in the NIL system, is how it kind of works. But there is kind of a part of that that they probably think that player is going to be better than you, right?
Absolutely. And I think that there is a different level of commitment required as well. Like, this is something that I don't think that parents and agents sometimes lose sight of this. I think that there is a very clear pattern that a freshman who gets to campus as not like the top name, Jack Bauer, when Jack Bauer got to campus, this does not apply to Jack Bauer. If Dylan Seward, who will not go to school, but if Dylan Seward gets to Tennessee, this will not apply to Dylan Seward. Let's give a very real example. Logan Schmidt, who just got to LSU, a surprise, you know, addition to LSU's roster. This, what I'm about to say, does not apply to Logan Schmidt. But the mid and lower tier high major freshman is the cheapest demographic for a college coach, period. those guys will undoubtedly earn the lowest on average on the roster. Are there outliers? Yes. Are there older players on a roster who are outliers to this and are earning less than the average for the demographic? Absolutely. However, if you get to campus as a freshman, a non-high class, five-star, high four-star freshman, because of the cheap nature of your commitment, a transfer will come in, may not be as good as you, but a transfer can come in and earn more money. The transfer portal is
usually will.
Lucrative. Usually will. The transfer portal is as lucrative as it's ever been. And so for a transfer to come over, if a school really, really needs, let's say, a third baseman, and they're looking for a former high major third baseman, you're a mid-major school, you're looking for a former high major third baseman who is a junior or senior graduate transfer who's going to be able to come in and have instant impact. Multi-year starter at a college level, maybe not a pro prospect, probably not if you're going to fit the demographic I'm talking about, but somebody who is going to come in and basically be an all-league caliber player for your mid-major conference. That guy is going to be the most expensive player on your mid-major roster for the most part. Are there exceptions? Again, yes, but I think that
we're talking in generalities.
Generalities from an earning potential perspective. It will be harder for you as the developmental freshman to earn than it would be if you take the start lower and work your way up the ladder through the transfer portal approach, which we know at this point objectively is the most lucrative way to go.
Even within that, to go back to recruiting, it's a dynamic that I remember years ago in the pre-NIL, pre-free transfer, all that era, right? I would talk to coaches and recruiters, you know, college recruiters and junior college coaches, and they would say, there's always this window. There's always this window as a junior college player, which is how much risk are you willing to take? Because the junior college player back then, the currency was not NIL, it was scholarships, right? But the junior college player who was willing to be patient in the summer, right? And again, we're talking about good players, not someone who's just trying to find a spot, but someone who was in high demand because you were viewed as someone who could step in and play right away. The players who committed in early got less scholarships than the players. Like if you were the last plausible shortstop, right-hander, third baseman, whatever it was left, you could end up with a full ride or close to it because the scarcity of the quantity of players that were being, seen for going after, as it went down, the offers went up. That's now kind of true. This kind of is the same economy going on now in the transfer portal, right? Which is even within the transfer portal. And again, these numbers are never verified, right? Generally, they're more of you hear them, generally it's impossible to fully verify them. However, there does seem to be a trend, which is the portal opens. The players who are the last ones who are of a certain level, who are still in the portal, the prices often go up at the end of that process, right? Because as the portal's getting closer to closing, scarcity really does kick in, and there's more teams sometimes out there looking to fill a spot than there are spot players to fill those spots.
Right, and I think that to tie this back to the high school side, like that is the thing that's the concern. Like if you are a mid-level high school player, coaches, let me back up a step here. The ultimate goal if you're a college coach is to win baseball games, period. Like you want to go and you want to win. You want to make players better. You want to give players the best college experience that you can. All of those are important things. So this is me not dismissing that in any way. But if you want to boil it down to one thing and one thing only, the goal is to go win. So if you need to tell a high schooler that there is no longer a spot on your roster very late in the cycle, because to your point, you need to go and get somebody at the very last second, even if they're expensive, the school will do that. We see it. It happens. There are schools that overcommit the amount of players that will ultimately be able to get onto their roster. And there are many of them. And at the end of the cycle, after the draft, they are forced to go back to some of these kids and families and say, we no longer have a roster spot for you. You need to go find another solution because we don't have a space.
After careful consideration, I have chosen to reopen my recruiting process, and I want to thank the staff on so and so. And by the way, that is the professional way to do this, right? 100%. But when you see those posts, understand if you need the decoder translator of that,
90%.
That is generally not that the kid woke up on July 31st and said, huh, I want to go to a different school.
100%. It is the vast majority of the time. That is after a tough conversation where the coach calls the kid and the family and says, I am so, so sorry, but there is just no longer a spot for you. It sucks. This is not like, I don't want to take away from the fact that that is horrible news to receive. If you are a parent, player, whatever you like, family member, agent, you don't want to get that phone call, but it is part of it. It is the system that we live in right now. And that is one of the byproducts, is that there are kids who are without spots. And so to tie this back to what we were talking about at the top of the show, I think that that has had the single biggest impact on the lack of regionality that we see now. I think that there are kids that need to look beyond the horizons and the area in which they may have contained themselves a decade ago or longer ago than that. And they're looking across the country because the opportunities are not as ripe within their area as they used to be. And there are also, and I think this is very important, pathways, the transfer portal, to going somewhere that is further away and lower level than what you anticipated in your backyard, playing a year, showing that you're good, getting on the field as a freshman. That's the kicker. You have to get on the field as a freshman. And then after you show that you can do it, you hit the transfer portal and the money is there to recoup whatever it is emotionally, financially, spiritually that you lost from going where you didn't expect to go as a freshman.
But I want to just emphasize one thing there that I would say slightly disagree with your mindset there, is it's freshman or sophomore, right? Like, which is sometimes, even if you have a freshman year, it may still behoove you to, okay, I'm at the window now where my choices, again, and it's hard to have no matter who you are in this, it is hard to have a real honest conversation even with yourself, right? But are you at the level where the school you want to go to, you're going to start as a sophomore? Or are you at the level where if you go there as a sophomore where you want to go to, that you're going to play? Because if you're going to only play some and you're going to battle to play, sometimes I think you're still better off probably spending 2 years somewhere than going to do that to where you're really ready to play.
Right. Well, let me just reiterate what I said a second ago, which is that the most lucrative path is that you go somewhere as a freshman, you prove that you can do it, and then you enter the transfer portal so that you have 2 years to go and do it somewhere else. That is the most financially lucrative path. Is it the best path for everybody? Absolutely not. But generally speaking, to make the most money, you're going to go somewhere, and let me actually to clarify again, to make the most money as a non-elite, already well-known high school prospect that chooses to go to school, the best pathway to a lot of money is going and proving that you can play as a freshman and then moving up throughout the college baseball world as a sophomore and, if necessary, again as a junior, which is a trend that we increasingly see. The multi-time transfer, so long as that is allowed, is becoming more and more common, as it should. You know, players should be able to take advantage of the system at their feet. Like, this is what it is right now.
Okay, so now I'm going to put on the hat of, you know, someone who's got a little bit of rose-tinted glasses looking backwards, right? And kind of decries this current, like, or even not even if you decry the current system, but you just talk to a lot of college coaches. You talk to college coaches all the time, but you just talk to a lot of recruiting coordinators and all. To kind of summarize this, there are strengths and weaknesses of this. Overall, though, is the sense that this system is utterly broken, is different but works, or is better than the old system? Because I will say, I can absolutely make cases where this is a better system, and absolutely where if you used to be that you could be kind of locked in somewhere, whether you're playing or not. And by the way, now you're not going to be in, you know, you're going to go from being $75,000 in debt coming out of school as someone who played to where now you can actually come out with money in your pocket. That's not a bad thing in any way, shape, or form. And that's one of the things you're just laying out here is that saying that a player finished their career with a successful career, they got their college experience, they got their education, they had a full scholarship, and they ended up, you know, making $200,000 over their 4 years of school, let's just say in this hypothetical world, is a much better system than I got covered books my freshman year. I got bumped up to, you know, like half scholarship for my junior and senior year. And I ended up with $75,000, $100,000, $125,000 in student loans, depending on wherever you are. This is a better system that way. But overall, what is the sense? Like, this is the modern world of what it is, but is it, what are the pluses and minuses as both for players, parents, but also programs and schools?
You know, let me ask you for clarification. In what sense? The pluses and minuses just in terms of being able to have the freedom of movement and to be able to go and make money? I think that the pluses and minuses are very apparent. Like, right, you have the ability to go and take advantage of a system that is effectively a free-for-all for you. You can go wherever you want.
If you
can transfer.
If you treat it as a business, which it is at some of these schools, right? It is a revenue-producing business. And if you think of it that way, there are advantages you can glean from it. It's also, it never was in a lot of ways, but if you really, I think though it does require having a mindset of an understanding that this is not the same as the average student who just goes to school at a school that they want to go to because they're a college student. And, you know, what you get into extracurriculars of whatever club you want to join when you're there. This is a very different thing than that at the same time.
This
the
is
old
this
school.
Is
a model. I'm going to go to somewhere and stay there for 4 years is much harder to do now.
It's much harder to do. It's much less desirable in a lot of cases. I think that's also important to say. Like, I don't know that that's the best path for a lot, the majority even of kids who we're talking about right now. The path that is probably the best for them is one that involves the transfer portal. I'll put it this way. Like, I think that this system right now is overwhelmingly pro-player to a fault. This system right now is largely lawless with almost no restriction on movement, on earning, on, you know, refusal to play, on eligibility. There is so much room to color within the lines here without breaking any rules that benefits the player. You want to start your career at, you know, name random school, at William and Mary, right? And then you go from William and Mary and you're outstanding there. We've seen this before. And you go to Virginia, right? And after going to Virginia, you're outstanding as a sophomore. At Virginia, you've moved up, you've gotten paid, and you decide, you know what? Virginia's not for me. Like, it's a great school, great coaching staff, but I want to go play in the SEC. So you go back into the transfer portal, you go to Texas A&M, and you have another outstanding season. You decide, you know what? I know that I'm not a professional baseball player. I'm a really good college player. I want to go get a degree. I'm going to go now to UCLA to set myself on a career to become a doctor, and I'm going to play one more college season at UCLA. You've done four schools in 4 years.
Now.
Exactly. You've done four schools in 4 years. You can earn money at every single one of those stops to varying degrees. You started as a lesser known freshman at William and Mary, and your career took you from the the A-10 to the ACC to the SEC to the Big Ten, and all along the way you have been effectively an employee. Guess what? That is the ultimate power to the player. That is a huge benefit to the player and their family. Is it a headache for the coaching side of it? You want to talk advantages and disadvantages for the coaches? It's a bear to put together a roster right now because there are a million factors at play. There is how happy everybody is. There's how much playing time everybody's getting. There's how much money everybody is earning. How much scholarship is your school providing? Yes, you can pay up to 34 scholarships, which is your entire roster. The majority of schools are not doing that. The majority of schools are dividing up somewhere between 10 and 18 scholarships. If you're in a really good spot, you've got 20 plus scholarships being paid for. If you're in an outlier spot, you've got 34. So all of these things have to be balanced in terms of keeping players happy enough that they want to stay at your institution. And if not, even at the slightest sign of trouble for a player and their family, it behooves them to basically enter the transfer portal and explore all options. There is no non-compete in college baseball right now, in college sports, period. You can go and work for whoever you want to work for however much money you want to work for. And it's all, you know, for a lack of better terms, shady, under the table business dealings that are unreported and off the record. And it's a mystery and it's inflated numbers all over the place. And so who does that benefit at the end of the day? The player and the player only.
The final point that I had to make here, and obviously I'll kick it back to you for however many final points you want to make, but the final point I want to make is that If you say, though, like another example of this, we talked a lot about the college player who's not a draft prospect, right? But the other thing that has happened here, and I do think really does pay off for players as far as their professional careers as well. Obviously, we had players like Rock Chulowski, who was the 1-1 pick and was at UCLA from his first day of college until the day he was drafted. And we have Von Lackey, and we have Drew Burris, and there are examples of that. But we also had in the first round, we had two players drafted in the first round whose college careers began in North Dakota, right? Because we had Carter Beck played, he started his career at Division II Mary, North Dakota College. I pride myself on having a very good understanding of where schools are. If you say Pittsburgh State, I can tell you where it is, and a variety of schools. I could not find where Mary is on a map right now. And we had Jake Shafter start at North Dakota State and then ended up at Carolina. We had multiple first-round picks who, the way I would put it is started their college careers at schools where you would say you do not in any way perceive that the offers you are getting are indicating that down the road you're going to be a first-round pick. Not just a pro player, but a first-round pick. And one of the things that's happened with this is, when you say about with the transfer rules and all this, I can tell you right now, if Carter Beck had stayed at Mary in D2, he would not be a first-round pick. Nothing against the program and all that. But you wouldn't have the scouts, teams would not have the comfort level that you've seen him against enough top-level competition to draft from the first round. Same thing with Shafter. That has changed now, where I think that there is a mindset shift that you've talked about, which is as a parent, as a student athlete, don't think of it as my doors are closed because these are the offers I'm now getting, because I used to get better offers and now I don't. All the doors are open now compared to that.
Yeah. The world is your oyster in that case. You should go to the, Marys and the Tampas and the, Cal Lutherans of the world that are very successful baseball programs, the LSU Shreveports of the world that are very successful baseball programs at their respective levels. Why? Because, again, you will be recruited. If you are good, they will find you. Whether they is a college coach or a scout, I don't know. We will see. Whether it's Baseball America, we may find you. It happens all the time. There's two very important things. One, it's that the ability to move up the food chain, if you can go and do it, wherever it is, it has never been better. You can and will move up if you're good. Also, to the scouts listening to this podcast, I have talked to many of you who have told me, and I think it's very interesting and important to the game right now, that there is more emphasis being placed every year on the value of scouting beyond the Division I ranks, beyond scouting the obvious. There are real resources being poured into understanding who the best D2 names are, understanding who the best JUCO names are, though that's always really been that way. NAIA has produced some valuable UDFA type signings. The Pirates signed Draven Ziegler, who was the national championship ace for LSU Shreveport in their undefeated season at the NAIA level. Well, that guy's gone on and he's been pretty decent. He's an older player. He's a reliever if he's ever going to make it. He's a mid-90s throwing right-handed pitcher, but he was outstanding as a junior at NAIA LSU Shreveport. And now he's a minor league baseball player who's gone on and been productive. So that guy doesn't get discovered, in my opinion, maybe as easily or as quickly as he would now, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And the reason for that is, A, there are Division I programs who want you. I know that Draven Ziegler, had he had more eligibility, Draven Ziegler would have been a guy that would have had Division I offers for the 2026 season to go and play big-time college baseball. I know it because there were teams that were looking into the possibility of acquiring a waiver for that to be able to happen. The Pirates signed him because the Pirates were abundantly aware of exactly what he was doing. And we have seen cases like that every year. It is a growing demographic. And so my point is this. it's a good time to be discovered if you're good at college baseball or if you're good at baseball in general. And I think that as much as the recruiting landscape has evolved and maybe pushed some of these kids who are a little bit more on the fringe to lower level Division I schools out of Division I entirely, there's a path to being really good still. There's a path to being discovered and playing professional baseball and making money doing this sport. It exists now. The infrastructure, I think, is as good as it's been. So I don't know, in conclusion, that all of this evolution, which in a lot of cases, in a lot of conversations, is made out to be generally negative. I think that people view this as a negative thing. I think in a roundabout way, with a lot of steps, this is really kind of good for everybody. And so we'll see how it evolves, you know, over the next couple of years, because I know that evolution is the goal. I think that clarity is the goal. But I do think that in this very pro player system, everybody can still win.
Well, that is the Baseball America College Podcast for this week. We're on our off-season schedule. So we will be back 2 weeks from now with our next college podcast, and we'll keep that just kind of rolling along. But do check out, we have a lot more stuff over on the YouTube channel, but also obviously at baseballamerica.com on college baseball, but on everything baseball related, majors, minors, college, fantasy, draft, collectibles, whatever you want, over at baseballamerica.com. For Jacob, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.